All right, thank you.
I thought maybe you've got enough of us at CCI, Tara.
Oh no, never. I really did intend to be there in person. Since our new director just started yesterday and Rick is not there, Chantal's doing the hearing, so she asked for us to be listening in. Hopefully DOLA will get funded for next year.
Well, good afternoon. And when did your new director start it?
She did start yesterday, a commissioner, but she's in the middle of onboarding, so getting everything moved over from the governor's office. So I'm sure she'll be there, but Chantal's actually doing the presenting. I think having to present to the JBC on your second day might be a bit of a stretch.
Very good. Two-minute warning, Mr. Dornkamper. We are almost there.
Okay, I'll be here on mute until I'm needed.
Very good. Thank you, Tara. You have any chance on the chasing you. Paula Christine chose cows too.
It's already pretty soon that she was like getting distance school this morning since we were out they had just week and as a countries we were out when she said we were making the government.
Well, not the wiener cats.
We assume may not have any of them.
Oh yeah, thank you.
No.
Yeah, one fly over there.
Well, good afternoon, everyone.
What's wrong with?
Good afternoon, everyone. I want to welcome all of you to the Las Animas County Board of County Commissioners work session. Today is December 5th, 2023. What's happened to 2023? It's already gone. It is 1 p.m., so we're going to call the work session to order. Please rise for an invocation by Commissioner Luis Lopez.
Please join me in reciting the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen.
Please join me on the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Welcome, everyone. Today, this work session, I just want to say thank you for being here today. And on behalf of Commissioner Tony Haas, he sends his regards. He had a family commitment he had to attend to, so he's not here today. And we have two public hearings, two presentations this afternoon. And so, and my fellow Commissioner Luis Lopez at 2 o'clock has another commitment. So we're going to have to stop this. So we're going to allot half an hour for this whole process. And having said that, I just wanted to make that announcement. Roll call, Mr. Dornkamp.
Commissioner Luis Lopez.
Here.
Mr. Felix Lopez.
Here. Approval of the agenda. Do we have any changes to the agenda?
No changes, Commissioner.
Okay, I'll entertain a motion.
Move to approve the agenda as presented.
Second.
Commissioner Felix Lopez?
Yes.
Commissioner Luis Lopez?
Yes. Yes, so we have today the discussion with GMS Consulting concerning the Model Water Users Association Community Development Block Grant application. So at this point in time, I'm just going to yield the floor to you, whoever wants to open it up. And I know we have with the Department of Local Affairs, Tara Marshall joining us as well. So we might be going back and forth. You want to come up to the, thank you so much.
Well, first of all, thank you for having us today. It's not just me representing Model, but all the Model board is here today. So I think that just shows great support that they all are taking time out of their busy schedules to show their interest in this. So my name again is Dana Kerniger, and I'm with GMS Consulting Engineers, and we are an engineering firm based out of Colorado Springs. We work with a lot of small rural communities, and we do the engineering. So our main thing we do is water, wastewater engineering. We do other types of engineering as well. But another component of having a successful project isn't just the design, but it's making sure that it can be funded and it can be affordable. So with the Model, we look at various options when we do a preliminary engineering report, which we completed earlier this year. We look at how can we make this affordable. The Model Water Users is kind of an interesting situation. So Model is very small. They actually service both Model and the neighboring community of Earl. And what makes them interesting is that they're less than 25 users. So what that means in the health department is, or actually less than 25 people, I should say. What that means for the health department is that they are not a public water system. You have to be over 25 people to be classified as a public health, public water system. So they lost that designation many years ago, about 10 years ago. And so what that, it's good in some ways because they're saving on regulatory costs. They're not having to do sampling they're not required to do any of that because they're not a public water system. The unfortunate part of them not being a public water system is that they have less access to funding. So you may say, okay, well, there's all this money out there that's for disadvantaged communities, and it is. There is money out there, but you have to be a public water system. That money right now is being facilitated through our state revolving fund. I've had lots of conversations with them specifically about Model, and they say, no, you have to be a public water system. So although there's 50% grant, 50% loan, and you know potentially they could access that, they cannot. The other reason why they cannot access that money is that they're a private nonprofit water company. The state revolving fund is limited by giving grant funds only to governmental entities. And so Model, as a private water company, cannot go through the state revolving fund. So even though all this funding coming from our federal government, they don't have access to that money. There is access to USDA rural development, which that's what they have done in the past. It's kind of considered the lending option of last resort. It is still going to be utilized in this project because we do need multiple funding sources to make the project affordable. The rural development, because it is a federal program, just has a lot of red tape and just takes a long time. I think Jackie actually could probably speak more to that than I can, because we really try to steer our communities away from it due to the burdensome of that particular funding source. Back to kind of what they need so that's kind of them as a whole and just funding. The project, we did a project for them in 2005, which included radium treatment with a cation exchange unit, a backwash water pond, and also distribution system improvements. One of the items that was also in that project was a replacement water line from Model to Earl, but it was not included in the final project because it was cost prohibitive. since about almost 20 years ago has passed, the softeners and for the cation exchange units, unfortunately, the manufacturer has not been responsive in helping the community. So they're Jackie's doing everything she can to kind of basically keep the system working. And even though they're not under any kind of public health requirements, they do feel obligated to treat for radium because that is a public health concern. So they would still like to keep treatment going. The other issue that's happened is the backwash water pond. So what happens is when the water is treated, you have backwash water that basically takes all the everything that's been filtered out of the system and goes into a pond. That pond has a liner that has degraded. We have seen actually several ponds, these membrane geosynthetic liners of that era have failed in across Colorado. And unfortunately, they are yet another community that is has that pond liner failing. Additionally, just the line in Earl is obviously, it wasn't replaced in 2005 and was an issue, it's still a problem. So that is essentially the scope of the project, is to have new units and to and then basically kind of rehab the facility, just kind of getting up to speed and up to current standards, and then as well as lining that pond and replacing the line. So that's the project, that's the total project scope. Just so you know, we explored other options. One of the options we explored was there is a water line that goes from Trinidad up to the Pinyon Canyon Maneuver site. So we're like, oh, that's like our golden ticket. And we even had got the Army to say that that was okay to use, which in the previous 2005 project, that was, they weren't favorable towards that. But the Army is favorable. However, one of the big challenges is that water from Trinidad is very expensive. I believe it's about $6.50 per 1,000 gallons. And most of the water use in model is actually agriculture. The ranchers use that for their cattle. And so if you're paying $6.50 per 1,000 gallons for water, that becomes not economically feasible for those that use their for the water. So that really eliminated that. I mean, if it was just residential use, that would probably be the best bet because it would, you know, it'd be treated water and it'd be all great. But the fact that a lot of their use is for livestock, that is not, it can't be, first of all, and Trinidad won't allow it. So
question real quick is, where is the water that this association is getting their water from now? Where's the source?
It's a groundwater well. So so really it's that Trinidad won't let it be livestock use and it's really expensive. So those two really eliminated that. We really were hoping that would be our golden ticket, but it isn't. With that, so we're looking at moving forward. We are gonna be looking at moving forward with the USDA rural development in their project costs in them, and then also with the community developed block grant. So the community developed block grant is a grant that's facilitated through the Department of Local Affairs. I think you guys are very well aware of like the Energy Mineral Impact Assistance Fund. So it's a program that is that I guess runs alongside of it. It's totally separate, and those funds come from the feds. So it is a HUD program. And what it allows is also it's for housing, but it can also be used for public infrastructure. We have been successful in administrating this grant program. It is more paperwork. You guys are used to the impact program, which is about the easiest, some of the easiest grant money to use. The community development block grant is not. We facilitate all of that paperwork. The advantage of the community development block grant for model is that one of the provisions for this, as you probably know, impact money can only be used for local governments. In the event for the CDBG money, it can be facilitated by counties or cities on the behalf of local government or local of a nonprofit. And so you can be a pass-through for model. And what that would really require is like the money was gonna come to you, and then it would go into the project.
So on that, since the CBVG program is basically federally regulated, would you have to comply with David Bacon?
Yes.
Bacon wages?
Yes.
Okay. And so the county would be the applicant that passed through?
Correct.
And as far as the fiscal agent, are you asking the county to be the same?
Yeah.
Doing all the reporting as far as...
Yeah, you would be the one applying, and you would be the one, you know, being the one to do all the pass the resolutions. There's quite a lot of resolutions that have to be passed. And then there's lots of paperwork kind of as we go along.
What is the amount that you're applying for?
The maximum amount that you can ask for is $600,000. So we will be requesting $600,000. And just something about our firm, we were actually the firm that did, when Community Development Block Grant came to Colorado, we were the first ones that administered the program. And we continue to administer the program. And I take pride in our company and my staff that of all the paperwork. So we would expect that this would be very minimal for you, that we would handle it, and we would work with also the USDA Rural Development and make sure that we have a full package to move forward. So what that would look like is we would give you the resolutions to pass. So you want to have to go onto the CDB website and figure it all out. We figure it out all for you. You would just be facilitating that.
Is there any indirect cost to offset some of the expenses that the county may be incurring? And I'm thinking our finance department is a team of one.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that perspective, if there is any indirect cost for us to, should we need additional hours within that office? I'm just, thinking of the reporting requirements.
Tara, can you address that?
So CDBG doesn't have commissioner indirect costs, so it'd be similar to EIF. One of the things that GMS successfully does is currently Ms. Coberly goes in on EIAF and actually fills out the report she and or Mr. Dornkamp do to submit. In this case with CDBG, GMS would do that. So GMS would handle the reporting that's required, but it's true as a pass-through organization, invoices would come to Los Animas County and need to be processed and paid through the normal course of paying invoices.
Thank you.
So when we get to the point of doing invoices, we would prepare the draws for you and then you would approve them. Interestingly, one project that we just closed out with Community Development Block Grant, we actually only did two draws on the CDBG money and it was complete. And so that was all. I mean, so approving the money and the pass through, it was actually consumed first. And we would, with the project, we would use the CDBG money first in the project and then utilize the rural development money. So hopefully it would actually be done, used quite quickly in once it went to construction. And then all the other paperwork, we would make sure that we gave to you. One of the things with CDBG is they have a closeout process. It's like a 12-page monitoring form, and it makes sure that you go to bid correctly, the contract documents are correct. We do all of that. So we go through all of our documentation. Actually, our admin takes and literally puts numbers on everything, and then we number it in the document. So we fill out the document for DOLA, and then we walk through it. It usually takes us like 45 minutes to an hour. Some communities that are not organized, it's like a half of a day to do it because it's that much paperwork. But we go through that. And I mean, to be honest, CDBG, they trust us. They trust us with it. They're like, okay, yep, okay, do you have this? And they kind of spot check to make sure that we do it right. But they are, they trust us with the process. So
your company is going to be overseeing the project from A to Z.
Correct.
To completion, and so any documentation, any paperwork that may have to go through to include RFPs or request for bid, whatever the case may be,
yes,
as the awarding. In the event of awarding those contracts, would GMS would have a representative to do the awards?
Yes.
And not necessarily for us, you know, for me personally, it would be a thing of liability, making the wrong decision on your behalf, on behalf of the people of Model. We just want to make sure that the transparency is there,
yeah,
and that we have basically the documentation. You're going to be the true north for this project from beginning to ending. And then at the end of the day, we'll report and everyone is happy. So we're just simply because as a county, have the ability to apply for those grants on behalf of our community.
Right. Very exactly. Good. Yeah. So we, when it comes to the construction side, you know, we do the advertisement for bids. We do the bid opening. We typically do the bid opening at our office, but then the bid award would, because that would be your authority to do that, we would come in person to present the bids to you, and then recommend. We would make a recommendation of who that award should go to, and then you would award it. So really, you would see us kind of at, you wouldn't actually see us physically very often. We would have one more public hearing. It does require a public hearing for the application. So you'd see me about another month from now, and we would do a public hearing for the application.
So question for you, Premier Chairman.
Yes, please.
Do we have a cost related to this at this point, or an estimation of what you're thinking? Because $600,000, is that enough? Or are you going to go after additional funding?
Oh, it's not enough.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, that's why we have to involve rural development into it. And so it's going to be in somewhere in the, it's in like the $1.7 to $2 million project. So the $600,000 is just a small, I mean, not a small portion, but it's, I wish it was more. I wish it could be a higher number so that the rural development part could be less.
Do you anticipate going into assuming debt for this project as well, or just that?
Yes. Yeah, there needs to be debt with it. But the one thing that the community, they have a pretty healthy reserve, and they definitely are at this point actually charging. Well, basically what we do is we look at how much revenues they have divided by number of customers, and they're in the positive every year.
Okay, and is there a deadline for this application process to start with the CDBG?
Yes, the deadline is actually February, I believe, 24th. So we would need to do the public hearing for the application sometime before that date. I would ask that date actually be prior to February 14th. They actually pushed back the date this year. Usually it's like February 17th, and we pushed it's a little bit later. So we would need to do another public hearing for the grant application.
And does your organization, GMS, have any history or record with other counties and acting in this capacity with other counties as a investor?
We are currently working with Lincoln County as that, and I believe in a way we've done it with Huerfano County. And Lincoln County is actually one that is presently happening right now.
Or maybe it's a question for Ms. Marshall, Tara. How common is this throughout the state other than this area? Have you seen this before?
Sure. So there are two that have happened in recent years. One is Montezuma County sponsored a grant through CDBG for a local daycare center that runs within their county. And then another one that has, the city of Rocky Ford recently, within the past 2 years, did one for a healthcare clinic in Rocky Ford. So those are two examples, one within the region. The one that Ms. Kroniger referred to in Huerfano County is the county has a public improvement district for Gardner. And currently GMS is doing a project in Gardner. Now, speaking directly about GMS's role with CDBG, in my years, they've done a project in Grenada, in Los Animas, in Ordway, in Manzanola, and they're doing one right now in Starkville. So they're working in Los Animas County with the Starkville water tank. A couple of thoughts on what Dana is mentioning. First, timeline. The grant would close in February. We won't make a decision until May. And then once we make a decision, we usually receive our federal allocation in July. So if awarded the $600,000, that would give an opportunity for GMS and model to work on their USDA application. The second thing in just thinking toward Commissioner Felix Lopez's questions about indirect costs, I think if you decide to pursue this, two thoughts. First, perhaps have model and GMS forward to the county a list of all the resolutions that will need to be adopted so that the county attorney can review them. Okay, I think we're agreeing you want to look at those resolutions.
That was going to be my concern there, Tara, before you go on with the next point.
Yeah.
If for some reason our legal counsel doesn't see that as conducive for the county to engage in, can another government entity such as South Central Council of Governments be the sponsor of this granting processes?
No, CDBG Community Development Block Grant can only be municipalities and counties. The water system doesn't exist within the boundaries of the city of Trinidad. So I'm not sure that that would be, I think if this is pursued, Los Animas County is the appropriate jurisdiction.
Thank you. Sorry for the interruption.
So no worries. I definitely think you want the county attorney to review all the resolutions so you can have a session and receive some legal advice. Second, I think it would be pursuant between the Los Animas County and model water company to have an IGA or MOU, whichever is the more appropriate document, over just laying out some of the things that GMS is proposing. And then I did have a question to Dana regarding the Lincoln County. For your services, for GMS's services, do you have a contract directly with Lincoln County, or is your contract with the Carville Water Company? How does your company retain the right to work on that project?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say they're a bit complicated because they started out the project as an enterprise of Lincoln County, because Lincoln County was like, how can we help them get access to more funds? So they made them an enterprise fund. And then later the state revolving fund said, no, they can't be an enterprise. So they're apart. So technically when we started our design services, it actually was under the county. So our contract is with the county. But that's a good question, Tara. I can find out, because I know we've done other projects like this before my time at GMS, if that contract was with the community or with the county. That you won't be facilitating the USDA rural development. Really, you're a pass-through. So I would still probably lean towards model being it, because really the burden of this project and the loan piece of it is going to be models, not the counties.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. So I think one, having the county attorney review all the resolutions. I think two, having the county attorney work up a agreement with model over what those responsibilities would be. And then in terms of timeline, just in closing, I would say to make that February 24th deadline, you probably need a decision in early February for sure as to where you're going. GMS may want that decision a little sooner. But those were my comments. I normally wouldn't recommend a CDBG grant because it's so onerous, but I will stand behind the fact that if you're going to do one, you want to do it with GMS based on their history in the region and with small jurisdictions.
So if I may, trying to speak out loud here. When you reached out to me about a month and a half ago?
Yeah, time goes by so quickly, I'm not sure.
This is the process to move forward, and I thank you for bringing it forward. And of course, the citizens and residents of Model are very important to all of us here in Los Animas County, especially me, that's my district, and those folks that live out there. So whatever the process is to move forward, I'm here to listen to see what the county can help, but of course we have to follow procedures and legal advice and all that. So I think the groundwork has been laid out for us to move forward with the next steps, in my opinion, with the seeing what the resolutions are, so our legal counsel can review
okay.
To see what type of overhead or administrative costs will be necessary, or indirect costs possibly, based on your information and or some sort of contract review with you and the model board, water district board as well, to for us to digest and absorb. Because if we're on a short timeline in February, we kind of really need to get this ball rolling sooner or later. And I apologize, it took us 2 weeks or a month to get you on the agenda, but last 2 weeks ago we were stacked up, so I couldn't get you in here.
No, it's fine.
But I think this is something that we can really dive into, for the simple fact of, as they are residents of this county.
Mm-hmm.
Again, legal counsel would have to give us proper guidance and moving forward to make sure that not only is the county protected, but the residents we represent as well as the model residents are protected as well.
Right. And just so that you're aware, that CDBG has something what they call as a guidebook, and those resolutions are all part of that. So it's pretty, it's standard language from the federal government. It's not language we're making up, just so that you're aware of that.
Very good. We have a few minutes. I'm going to, any questions from a finance director or county administrator?
I've got one. Can you forward all the documents you have, like the scope of work, what exactly?
Mm-hmm.
You folks anticipate doing with the grant monies and rural development monies, or
yes,
replacing water lines and stay going down the road there with a new body.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
The only thing is that if it's a rural development copies of everything for our audit, for everything, and we'll probably have to amend our budget $600,000.
It won't be for your 2024 budget.
2025.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's even better.
Yeah, it will be awarded in July, and we're already starting the environmental process with USDA Rural Development. The CDBG also has an environmental process, and we can't go under contract until we have environmental clearance. So I don't think, it's possible, but most of our projects,
And has CDOT been included in this conversation yet, or the utilities department, or will that even be necessary with Highway 350?
I don't know. I mean, we're still working on that alignment. If the alignment does end up being in the right-of-way, then we work with them once the design. At this point, the design is not, we haven't initiated that. So we have not began any conversations with CDOT at this point.
Okay.
This may have been answered, but county administrative costs covered?
No, that's what Tara made. Yeah. But I really would anticipate those to be really minimal, because we facilitate, like we get into the port, the dole plural, we do all of the reporting. So I would hope that you would walk away and go, great, let's have GMS do another project for us. That okay, so I know we're coming close to the end.
I want to say thank you for bringing that to us. Definitely we'll go ahead and have our conversations, and this should be on the agenda for us to approve whether we proceed forward or not. In the meantime, I really want to, the communication that Doran Camp is asking for, which it please forward,
mm-hmm,
and all scope projects, so on and so forth.
Okay. And so all my communication will be with,
yes,
with Phil. Okay, that's great. Correct. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
We don't want to have any implications
something
down the road of not following procedure.
No, that's typical with the community, the counties I work with. I work with the county administrator. So great.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for being here. Okay.
Pray for rain or snow. That would help.
And if it would be great if we could have a decision. I mean, not, Tara said early February, but we will need to do the public hearing and the application.
We can have our county attorney digest it and then we'll...
Okay, great. Thank you so much for your time and your willingness to hear us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Have a good afternoon.
See
you. See you. Have a good day. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to call on our next presenter, Mr. Tom Murphy. And again, Mr. Murphy, I'd like to remind you, we have Commissioner Luis Lopez has committed shortly after 2 p.m. So we're going to have to adjourn the meeting around 2.
Right.
Okay. Based on, because we need to have a quorum to have this work session. So
I didn't know. I specifically asked back when we did this in November that I have time to do this. So we have Cora Mestis that came here all the way from Florence. And then we have Morgan Shire and her family, and she took the day off of work. I didn't know that I would be
constrained. Life happened today, so we just need to certainly apologize for the inconvenience. And if you have any, communicate with our account administrator. And if there's any information that you might need to discuss, certainly we can.
This involves the county, and I don't want to race through this, but now I'm going to have to race through this because Mr. Mestis has things to say, and Ms. Shire has things to say, and you need to hear this because there's some potential liability. I mean, I thought for sure that your attorney would be here too. I've given you handouts, and we're going to go through this. We are live streaming right now. Zach, my stepson, is going to be putting these documents that I've given to you on. People are watching right now. I've been doing things long enough. I guess I shouldn't be surprised that I was going to get a curveball. I just don't want to race through this. I wanted to do this slowly and methodically so that you guys understood, because there are a lot of moving parts to this. And it's not easy. And this is a county issue. And if I had known that it was going to be 30 minutes, I wouldn't have asked these people to come here. Are you guys okay with me proceeding? Okay. I'm going to do the best I can. Let me look and see what I have here. How much time do you have after 2 o'clock?
I've got to be gone by 2.
Good afternoon, Commissioner, staff, people in the audience, and those who are watching online or watching on my YouTube channel, Trinidad Times TV, via my live stream. For the record, my name is Thomas Murphy, and I am the owner of Malaire Murphy Funeral Home and Trinidad Times TV. With me today is Carl Mestis, who is the owner of Starkville Cemetery in Morgan Shire. Daughter of Dave Shire went missing February of 2022, about a mile and a half from the Starkville Cemetery. Before I get started with my presentation, I want to do a little housekeeping. I've known both of you, Commissioners Felix Lopez and Luis Lopez, for decades. I don't want people that are watching to think that I'm being disrespectful or flippant by calling each of you by your first name, but I am likely to resort to that if we get into more dialogue at the end. Now, we won't have time for that. I also ask that you not interrupt me until I'm finished. I have tried to condense a lot of complex information into as tight a presentation as I could. When I am done, some of my colleagues may wish to speak, and you should allow that. If there were some people here to speak on Mr. Berker's behalf, I would have said you should allow that. When we're all finished, your attorney might even advise you not to say anything, not to ask any questions, and I'll understand that. Because we're opening a huge legal can of worms for Los Angeles County. Anyway, I was hoping everybody would be here. Carl Mestis is the owner of Starkville Cemetery. He and I spent more than 3 hours a while back explaining the story to Ben from the Chronicle News, and I think he still is confused. Unless you are in the death care business, as I am, you're going to have many more questions to ask when I'm done. But I don't want to spend all day here any more than you do. This is important to our community and to a family whose loved one that went missing and may be buried in that cemetery. So please have patience to listen to everything we have to say and let the chips fall where they may. Why am I doing this in a meeting with county commissioners? I understand that this is not a court of law, but what I'm about to share with you is a reflection on all of our community, especially the county government. As elected officials, it especially reflects on each of you as elected officials in our community. Luis, you addressed the issue at the last commissioner meeting that elected officials need to be held accountable. You're speaking about District Attorney Henry Solano, if I recall correctly. This is what accountability looks like from someone who's not afraid to challenge the government and not awaiting for the next election. Also, because it is my First Amendment right to free speech, also my right to petition the government for a redress of grievances, and lastly, as county commissioners, you're going to find that Los Angeles County might be complicit in the potentially illegal activities of an elected official Los Angeles County may be facing litigation by numerous injured parties. Also, each one of you, before you sat in these commissioner seats, swore an oath to the Constitution of the United States and to the Constitution of the Colorado to uphold the law. In my opinion, your job is not just to represent the constituents, but to protect each and every one of us and everyone who travels through our community as tourists. Those who are homeless and living in our community. And lastly, those souls whose earthly bodies have been buried in our community. I will add that each one of you profess your Christian faith when you openly pray before each meeting. I too was born into the Christian faith, Catholic to be specific. I probably missed Mass growing up fewer times than I have fingers on my hands. Those values were instilled in me by my parents and my faith. It is the reason I am now putting my reputation and my family's safety at risk by bringing a highly volatile situation to light in this community. In 2017, I made an open records request on the Colorado Coroners Association to try and obtain this signed document, and I'll explain why later. Colorado Coroner's Code of Ethics. As a county coroner or coroner investigator, my fundamental duty is to serve mankind in the process of a thorough, comprehensive search for truth through medical legal death investigation. Honesty, integrity, competence, compassion, and fairness will be my guidelines. I will obey all laws and adhere to regulations of my department. Confidentiality will be kept at all times. That's important later. Unless necessary information is to be shared in the performance of duty, personal feelings, prejudices, or friendships will not influence my decisions. I recognize my position as a public trust, and I will be true to these ethics. I will continue to study, train, and to work to advance scientific knowledge in my chosen field. I will readily seek consultation and the use of talents and knowledge of others. I will constantly strive to achieve these objectives and ideals, dedicating myself to justice. Zach, that would have been number one, is it up? Okay. Number two and three, then four and five. You want to know what the Colorado Coroners Association told me after, when I did the open records request on them? They told me pretty much to go to hell. They said we weren't a government organization and they didn't need to comply. I followed up with the same open records request in Los Angeles County Coroner, and he told me the same thing. You have it in your documents. It's four and five. It's like Los Angeles County having policies and procedures that you can't use county equipment for side hustles, but you don't bother to enforce it even when you know what's happening. These are words on a piece of paper with absolutely no meaning or consequences whatsoever. Have you ever studied elementary logic? You know from Spock, from Star Trek, the premise number one, that the Colorado Coroners Association refuses to share a document with one of its members that says a person will follow a code of ethics. Premise number two, the coroner is also asked to share the document of the code of ethics and refuses. Is it fair to conclude the coroner has already acknowledged that he is not going to be honest, have integrity, competence, compassion, and fairness, that he will obey all laws and adhere to the regulations of the department? The answer for me is yes. And it is an admission of a completely unethical, amoral, compassionless human being that became an elected official in a popularity contest. His sense of entitlement extends to his belief that this is his county, community. He actually said that to Frederick Marshall, that he would have him arrested if he came to town to exhume a dead body, a deceased body, and that he can do whatever he wants. Apparently, he believes that the law doesn't apply to him. Now, clearly, I'm not beating around the bush. I'm here to call for Dominic Junie Berker's immediate resignation and all his deputies and an independent law enforcement agency, the Attorney General's office specifically, and potentially the CBI to conduct a grand jury investigation into his actions, his deputy's actions, and an employee of the District Attorney's Office, Margaret Marier, her actions, and potentially some employees of Los Angeles County. So the investigation should include the coroner's office, the District Attorney's Office, and staff at Los Angeles County. I've recently been doing open records requests on numerous state, county, and local elected officials, and I know that I have not been given all the information that I've requested. I suspect that I only have the tip of the iceberg, and I believe the only way to get to the truth is to question people under oath, with a potential committing perjury as a guardrail to find the truth. I'm still waiting on open records requests from the coroner, who told me Friday that he would get them to me. I said I would get him a check Saturday. I still haven't heard from him. And from the Department of Human Services. So my goals today will be one, to convince you and other members of the community. This is number six act. And people outside our community that may have been impacted by the actions of Dominic Virker to sign a petition calling on the Attorney General and the CBI to begin an investigation. Number two, to have DNA tests done on any human remains that the coroner has handled in the last 2 years, and especially those buried in the Starkville Cemetery and St. Anthony's Catholic Cemetery. Three, that the potential that any of those previously stated remains to be examined be determined if they are potentially the remains of Dave Shire, who went missing a year and a half ago, a mile and a half from the Starkville Cemetery, and that the property today be immediately taped off as a potential crime scene. Before I begin the reason for this meeting, I want to give you a brief history of my life growing up in the funeral service business, or as some like to refer as the death care business. My earliest memory at 4 years old in 1965 is seeing my father embalming a body after my mother left me to play outside the embalming room. She took my younger sister Ann somewhere and she told me not to open the door until my father came out. Of course, I opened the door. I can still see the deceased elderly man lying on the embalming table with the blood running down through the trough and my father with a cigarette in his mouth, which I later learned was a way to mask the smell of formaldehyde, both of which may have later contributed to his death from cancer. I wasn't scared at that time. I just asked why he didn't save the blood for someone who might need it. He laughed and said, it doesn't work that way. Viewing other deceased bodies, of course, followed as I was growing up because that was my father's career. And what followed with that is this core principle he instilled in me and that I follow today. Every one of the deceased bodies that I handle was someone's loved one. And you treat them as if they were your own loved one. By Colorado law, a deceased body is supposed to be either embalmed or refrigerated within 24 hours. I put a morgue refrigeration unit capable of cooling or freezing the human body back in my facility back in the early 90s. In fact, the coroner at that time, Mark Ritz, used to store bodies in my facility until the Justice Center was built. Then they could transfer them up north for an autopsy. No one else had a cooler in Trinidad at that time, and for me, it was a matter of following the law, and I think it was almost 10 years that I stored bodies for the coroner. So why have I asked you for this special meeting? I imagine everyone here is familiar with the Return to Nature Funeral Home in Colorado Springs. In Penrose, where almost 200 decomposing bodies were recently discovered. Why would anyone handle a single human remains or multiple human remains in such a callous manner? I think I know why, and it falls under the lust for money, and that there are no boundaries that people won't stoop to in order to get more money, and it fits the description of me of moral turpitude. I suspect some of you know what the definition of moral turpitude is. Moral turpitude, a phrase that describes wicked, deviant behavior constituting an immoral, unethical, or unjust departure from ordinary social standards, such that it would shock the community. The 200 decomposing bodies in Penrose in a situation that happened recently in Los Angeles County that I and others uncovered meets the definition of moral turpitude in my book. On September 6, 2023, I was present in the Starkville Cemetery where I took pictures and video of a man's remains being exhumed. So that's 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, and it's in your books too. No, it's not. I'm sorry. I forwarded that to Mr. Dornkamp and asked him to share them because it wasn't going to print out well. I'd been notified by the owner, Carl Mestis, who is sitting here with us today, the week before that a funeral director, Frederick Marshall, was coming to Trinidad from Denver to exhume the body of a man that had potentially been identified as a homeless man that died in Trinidad in 2019. As we later found out, he may have been buried and later exhumed more than once for DNA testing. Carl explained to me that the week before that he had discovered in 2022 that the Los Animas County coroner, with the assistance of the Los Animas County Road and Bridge crews, had buried several bodies in the cemetery without his knowledge. When he told me this, I became very interested because that certainly wasn't legal to bury bodies without notifying the owner of the cemetery. It clearly states on the burial permits, which you have, I've buried bodies in that cemetery over the years, and when you enter it, I would describe it as a north. Let me start over here. I've buried bodies in that cemetery over the years, and when you enter it, I would describe it as a north side and a south side. The north side is the newer side, as it has far more recent burials on the hill, and the south side is an older section that slopes to the south. The grave was on the south side where the ground is sloped, which I thought was odd because a rain or snowfall would wash away any remnants of a grave. There's a gully just a few feet away too that the dirt would run into, and it has. There was one green grave marker that is in the picture, mine are black. Carl told me that there wasn't that grave marker wasn't even there when he first went to examine the grave. Mr. Berker informed Carl that day that three bodies were buried in the cemetery by him and that he didn't have any paperwork or a burial permit. A burial permit can only be produced in the state system, the EDR, electronic death registration, after a death certificate is signed by the doctor or the coroner. While we were at the gravesite, I asked Frederick Marshall for a copy of the death certificate, and he shared a worksheet copy with me. That's number 18, Zach. What you'll see is that listed as the funeral home is Los Animas County Coroner. I thought that was odd, but I know that anyone can be listed as a funeral home, but it is extremely rare. And why was the coroner doing that? As the grave was being dug, we found out that there were two bodies in the grave. Did you share those pictures?
I did.
People that are watching, that's number 19. What I said earlier about moral turpitude, that fits the definition. And as Frederick Marshall will tell you, those bodies were buried foot to head. That is absolutely worse than moral turpitude. I don't have words for that. What human being would put bodies in a grave that more than likely is for eternity, head to foot, 69? And now we suspect, after rehashing our conversations between myself and Carl and Morgan, and the conversations that we had at the gravesite, there might be a third or a fourth body in that grave. We don't know. Because Carl was told that we should go down 8 feet. We only went down 6 feet. So there might be another body under the body that's there. While we were there, we found out that next to the grave that was being exhumed was a grave of another person that was buried in a box. That person was reportedly a woman, according to Carl's cousin Pete. I later did an open records request on Mr. Berker, 24, 25, and 26. Let me rehash here where I'm going with this. Berker tells Carl that there are three bodies buried in the cemetery, no burial permits. My open records request, Berker lists four bodies. None of the four bodies are female, unless the L. Porter one that was buried by Comey Funeral Home is a woman. And all four bodies listed died in 2019. By 2023, they would have decomposed, if not embalmed. Frederick Marshall had to stand on the second body to exhume the first body. Frederick Marshall is probably one of the most experienced funeral directors in exhuming bodies in the country. He has done literally hundreds of exhumations. I've never done one. I later asked him if the second body had been embalmed. He said no, because the embalming chemicals would have stained the body bag. He did say that he thought the body had been in the ground that long. Started thinking Dave Shire. Maybe 4 months to 2 years. I didn't think anything about that until I was telling my wife, Paula, at the Toyota dealership about the case. And it continued to grow with suspicious circumstances. Our friend Darby Shire was sitting a short distance away and asked, "This is Friday the 13th of October." And she said, "Is it possible one of those bodies is my dad?" And dawned on me at that point. He completely disappeared a mile and a half from that cemetery. His shop is a stone's throw away. It dawned on me, what a perfect place to hide a body. In a rural cemetery that doesn't have regular maintenance. It was at that point, everything changed for me. There are people sitting here. And this is what bothers me about 30 minutes. They came home and their loved one was gone. Imagine that one of your loved ones, when you got home tonight, was just gone. And you didn't find them. Imagine the pain. There are people sitting here that know that pain. And they are still trying to find him. The man that was exhumed, his daughter searched for years, dealt with the police here for years, and dealt with Verker, who was very hostile towards her. This isn't right. This is a reflection on us. I'm going off script here now. This is my emotion that's speaking. I really feel for the Shire family. I can't even imagine that pain, what that's like. Luis, you know a little bit of that pain because somebody took your father's ashes. That had to hurt. So please understand that these people are here because it's possible. It is possible. Is it unusual for a coroner to be acting as a transport company and firm with government equipment? Not in Los Angeles County. I did an open records request on Mr. Verker and I asked where he was burying. That's 27 and 28. It dawned on me, maybe he wasn't being completely forthcoming. So I called Gaylene Chavez at St. Anthony's Catholic Cemetery in Aguilar, where I've buried people. And I asked if Verker had buried any bodies as the coroner up there. She said there were two. And then she called me back and said, no, there's one. And I said, can I have a copy of the burial permit? That's in your list too. That's 27 and 28. And what struck me as I'm looking at this actually didn't strike me. It struck my stepson, Zach, who's sitting here. He looked at it and he said, Tom, there's no signature on that. And then I sent it to my friends at a funeral home in Pueblo. And they said, Tom, there's no state seal on that. And there's no bullet points. I called Michelle Kyle at the state and I said, is it possible to produce this document without those things, without running it through the state system as you legally need to do? No. I did another open records request on Mr. Verker and he hasn't replied, asking specifically when these people died, because we need to know when that happened. Now, you're likely to hear what the coroner did was lawful. What we need to before we have that discussion is to gather all the facts. I asked many questions through open records and I've gotten some answers. This is another reason for an independent grand jury to get the answers. I've done the best I could with experience as a reporter through open records and now share with you a very complex and disturbing situation that has happened in our community. Shortly after September 6th, I did an open records request in the county and asked what records they had as far as digging graves. I said, there are no records. So as I'm doing more and more records or research, I did a records request again on the county. I got that this last week. Because I don't understand how Dominic Verker is using county equipment and crews if he's not contacting through Mr. Dorenkamp, which is, I think, the last letter. What I got back from Mr. Dorenkamp, well, first, let me back up. I knew in 2015 and 16 things were going on, and I came to the county then. I had to let this slide, and I'm running. If I had time, I would be
I postponed my appointment. We'll go till 2:30.
Thank you, because I've raced through. Now I can slow down again. My mind was already okay. Thank you. Now I can relax a little bit. I knew in 2015 and 16, and I'm not going to get into that story because I want to let these other people a chance to speak, that there were issues with the coroner. I'd like to get into that, but if Morgan wants to speak and Carl wants to speak, I want to let them do that. I found out again this year that Berker and his deputies were transporting bodies using county equipment. I came to Mr. Dornkamp in early August, sat down with him, showed up unannounced, told him the things that happened in 15 and 16, and that it was happening again. I assumed in my open records request that he would have communicated that with you.
So what are you insinuating?
I'm not insinuating anything. I'm going to finish. It's in the thing. What number is that there, Zach? Number 29. Go to page 29. So I asked for communication between Mr. Berker and Mr. Dornkamp and road crews. And in that response, there's a road crew that says, we dug a grave 2 weeks ago. And we haven't put it in the system yet. Mr. Dornkamp's response is, don't bother putting it in. I'm going back to when I asked if there were any records in September, September 13th, there are no records of graves being dug. So I'm confused at this point. If there are records or they're not records, because 29 clearly states that there's records that have been put into a system. We're trying to determine when the bodies were buried. We don't know that from Mr. Berker or from the county staff. I've been using the county for 40 years to dig graves. You do it at no cost. It's a heck of a service. I included that in a letter from 20 years ago. So the issue that I have now is this with Berker. Is he's operating as a funeral home. He's taking funeral business away, that list that you have in there with all the bodies that he's buried. He's using county equipment, county time, and he's competing against funeral homes, operating as a funeral home. You have a policy that says you're not supposed to be using equipment for private purposes. This is a nice side hustle. I'm going to let other people speak, but if you go to 789, the ambulance did that to the tune of $60,000 over 15 years. I put an end to it in 2006 because the other funeral home was using them to pick up all their bodies. So now, and you have in there that I went after Berker in 2017 open records request. He admits that he does removals for them using county equipment. And now I have it again. I'm tying this all together, 2006, 2017, 2023. At this point, I won't let these people speak. Look at number 29. I sure would like an explanation that there are either records of these bodies being dug by the county and coordinates, because that's what it asks, or there isn't. I don't know. Morgan?
Thank you for all being here. Thank you to my mother, Rosemary Shire, for being here. And to my brother, Brad, for driving down from Kersey, Colorado, which is near Greeley. And to my sister, Victoria, for being here today, who lives here in Trinidad with us now. And thank you to my siblings who cannot be here, siblings and family who could not be here, who are watching live stream. I am extremely grateful to our community who has worked so hard to find my father. And thank you, Tom, for alerting us to this issue and working hard to put some of the pieces together. And thank you to Sherry, Frederick Huff's daughter, who so painstakingly searched for her father, Frederick Huff. And it may be that in her discovery of her father, we may find our own. And my name is Morgan Shire, and as many of you know, my father was David George Shire, who mysteriously went missing on February 11th of 2022. I'd like to share something I wrote a few months ago that captures the ongoing agony of having a missing family member, and what it's been like at times to continue being a wife, a mother of two small children, and a physician in a small town. And the agony that I invite back into my life and my family's life today. that has recently quieted. It's called Within Reach. It's the uninvited prayers that drive me out of my body into the place where jagged hooks precipitate on the edges of thoughts. Where sweet relief is found curled up on the bathroom floor. Where I can't tell if I long to feel nothing or everything. It's just the same as when I lived in the depths of the sea until you put me in a tank and all I could do was swim in circles, catching myself on razor edges of plastered coral while well-meaning children bored their fingers into glass. I'm tired of being on display. I'm so sorry for your loss and how painful it must be to not have closure. Fillet me with sous chef precision. I've tried the hard no. I do not want to talk about it. I've tried grace, and then somehow I feel like I've ripped out my own heart and given it to you on a silver platter, and then say, I'm actually quite full. And then you say, I've imagined uprooting my family and moving to Australia, and all I get from this is how much my kids will miss their friends. I've imagined writing it all down. And so here I am writing it all down on the cold bathroom floor. And suddenly I'm not crying anymore. Hooks become anchors and prayers moving pen tip to self-portrait. It's a start. There's only certain people I feel safe to grieve with, and I'll have to sort out what makes them safe later. It's a start. I know that jaggedness is actually love too, and that I never actually left still in these waters. Home is always within reach. Today, I won't read that part, but my sister Darby and I have often found comfort in the idea that our father had simply peacefully returned to nature. However, upon hearing that during the exhumation of Frederick Huff, an unidentified person was discovered in the same grave just a mile away from our home, I was reminded of the dark places my mind has gone since my father's disappearance. I am here today to officially ask my community to have DNA tests done on any human remains that the coroner has handled in the last 2 years, and especially those buried in the Starkville Cemetery and St. Anthony's Catholic Cemetery, that the potential that any of these previously stated remains be examined to determine if they are potentially the remains of our father, David Shire, who went missing a year and a half ago, a mile and a half from the Starkville Cemetery. It's hard to know what details to share here, and I know this is not a court of law, but it's my hope that since being home the past 3 years, that you've come to know and trust me, and after hearing my story, you will stand with me in asking for these bodies to be identified. And if corruption is revealed in the end, then may we all grow and be changed from this process. Many of you may not know, that my father was actually last seen on a neighbor's game camera footage just south of his home. He appeared to be in good health in the photo. It seemed as soon as the footage was discovered, 2 weeks after his disappearance, that the assumption was made that he was just an old man who walked off into the sunset, and that very well may be. Many of you know that he had a shop, a junkyard, we call it the junkyard, just south of town on the way to Starkville. It was not uncommon for him to walk to the shop, but it snowed that evening, and it was hard to imagine that he would have survived the night. Other than the picture, not a crumb of evidence was ever found to my knowledge. If he had been attacked by an animal, where was the blood? We never found his black hat, his shoes, his wallet, or his cell phone. And there was no footprints, no pathway through torn branches, no attempts to reach us from his cell phone, completely disappeared. I had the opportunity to speak to the funeral director, Frederick Marshall, who performed the exhumation of Mr. Huff. He's done hundreds of exhumations and modestly admits that he is an expert. I asked him to describe the body beneath Mr. Huff, who Mr. Huff was found face down, head between the unidentified man's legs. The unidentified man also in a body bag. Mr. Marshall stated that the body was of a person weighing approximately 138 to 150 pounds. My father weighed 155 pounds at his last doctor's appointment. Mr. Marshall stated that he could still feel skin attached to muscle, a hallmark of a freshly buried body between the estimate of 4 months and 2 years, and was most certainly a male. Most disturbingly is that when I took a close look at the picture in which you can see the body bag beneath Mr. Huff's, is that there appeared to be two long skinny legs. I am a physician. I am privileged to be with people in the final days and often final breaths of their life. And I am privileged to witness the breaths of babies, first breaths of babies, as they come into this world. And I am privileged to be a part of a community that has held me so tenderly in my grief. So thank you. My solace has always been that we all come from the same oneness. And even though my father was likely alone at the time of his death, that none of us is really ever alone. Please, I beg you to help us identify these individuals buried by the coroner. And if it doesn't turn out to be my father, then we will likely have identified someone else's loved ones. And if there is no one else to claim these individuals, then I claim them as sacred as my own father. Thank you.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Bear with me. I just had some dental work done. My mouth is sore and it's dry.
Okay. Here is
I'm sorry?
Fresh water.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey. It's not closed. Yeah, it's closed.
My name is Carl Mestis. I own the property where the cemetery is located in Starkville. On October 19th, 2022, I received a certified letter from a lady named Sherry Alice of Oklahoma. She informed me that her father, a homeless man, had died here in Trinidad and was buried in Starkville Cemetery. She had gotten my address from Jody Amato, the county assessor, and she didn't have a phone number, so she sent me a letter. I called her. During the conversation, it became apparent that conversations between her and Mr. Berker had become hostile. She had asked to visit the gravesite, possibly arrange for memorial service and placement of a headstone. Mr. Berker told her that he had no way to contact me to ask for access to the property. Mr. Berker had never contacted me to even let me know that the burial had taken place, nor to give me a phone number to call Miss Ellis. Now, if Miss Ellis was able to get my contact information from Jody Amato, Mr. Berker should be able to do that. And as a county official, he should have known he could have done that. And if he'd have gone to her, Miss Amato would have probably sent him across the hall to speak to my sister, Patricia Mesta of Hill, who was county clerk at that time. And I am sure that somebody would have given him my phone number. So there's no excuse for him not getting my contact information. I called Mr. Berker to inquire as to what was going on. When he answered, he said, "Hi, Chris, that's my middle name." I asked how he knew who was calling. He said, "Your name come up on my phone." Okay, so obviously on my phone, your name doesn't come up unless you're in my contacts. So if my name came up on his phone, obviously he had my phone number. Still to this point, he never tried to call me. Obviously at that point, he had the phone number. He could have got it from several people. The person that he got to open the cemetery, the gate into the private property, was my cousin Pete Valdez. Pete would have had my phone number. The caretaker, Leroy Valdez, my other cousin, he would have had my phone number. There were several people he could have contacted to get my phone number. The conversation with Mr. Berker made it plain that he and Miss Ellis had become hostile to each other. He was adamant that Miss Ellis should not be allowed to the property. He said she was out to sue somebody and that he was afraid she would injure herself on the property and try to sue me, which is kind of crazy because we have funerals up there. People drive up to the cemetery in a vehicle. They get out, they walk along, never had anybody hurt. Okay, it didn't make sense. So he could have been given access and he just never called me. He never called me at all. Several days later, I met Mr. Berker at the county morgue. He told me that he would not escort her to the site. This is my county. This is my county. I'm the coroner. This is my county. And she's not going up there. Well, it's not his property. He may be the county coroner, but it's not his county. He gave me a copy of the death certificate and the autopsy report with the grid coordinates that he claimed to have provided to Ms. Ellis. In further conversation with Ms. Ellis, I asked her about Facebook posts, because when she called me and I noticed that her conversation was hostile, I'm thinking, what is this lady about? And then Berkers tell me she's liable to sue. So I had my wife look up on Facebook, and she had made a post in there that she was told that the property owner was known to shoot at people. I asked her, where'd you get that information? She says, from Mr. Berker. I said, well, you know what? I'm a fierce defender of the Second Amendment, but I never shot at anybody, nor would I. So it was at this point that I determined that Mr. Berker had something to hide. He had something to hide. Ms. Ellis got back to me. I got back to Ms. Ellis and let her know that I would arrange a time so that she could visit the site. She called in November of 2022. I had just fallen and torn my rotator cuff, and I was going through therapy. So I asked, can we wait till maybe the weather gets a little better and I recuperate, and I will meet you down there and take you to the cemetery so you can visit or decide what you want to do. Because at this point, she decided she might want to exhume the body and take it back to Oklahoma. Well, shortly after, while I was recuperating from the injury, my mother died in November. And then my sister died in April. And so she was supposed to call me back around the spring of the year. She finally did call. She finally did call about the last week of August, early September, letting me know that her father was to be exhumed the next week so that his remains could be taken to Oklahoma. She gave me Fred Marshall's name, who is the mortician from Denver. He's the professional exhuming bodies. I called him. And the first words out of his mouth that Mr. Berker was hostile to him. He told him the same thing. You're not coming down here. This is my county. You're not going into that cemetery. And if you do, I'll have you arrested. So I came down here to get some more information. I went to talk to my cousin Pete Valdez that had opened the gate and was present when the bodies were buried. It was at that time that I found out Pete. He says, well, you know what? If this is becoming a mess, you're really not going to like what I have to tell you now. There are three bodies up there. I said, three bodies? He said, yes, there are three. So then we have the exhumation on September the 6th. I was surprised to find that when we opened the grave, there was two bodies in there, and just in body bags. In the Starkville Cemetery, we're not required to use concrete vaults, but we do use a casket or a box for remains. And if it's a casket, we put it inside of a wooden box. The reason we do that is because there's old graves there. So if you're digging a new one, you're going to hit the box before you bust open the casket. Okay. To my knowledge, we have never done what they call a green burial. When you opened this grave, there was two bodies just laid one on top of the other, not even any dirt in between them. And that's pretty sick to me. That's disgusting. Okay. So then, while this had been done, I asked Mr. Berker why he had not told me that there were three bodies. And his response wasn't on purpose. I just didn't. So I asked him, I said, do you have the permits? He says, I don't think there are any permits. And I said, well, if you buried bodies here, there's got to be permits. And I said, the second thing is, I want to know the identity of those bodies. These are human beings. They need to be identified. They deserve the dignity of a proper burial, and this should never have been done. That was September 6th. I have yet to get word from Mr. Berker as to the identity of the bodies. And now, according to Mr. Murphy, there may be as many as four bodies up there, or possibly five. So we've got a problem, gentlemen. We've got a real problem. Here's the bottom line. If he'd called me and asked me, can we bury a body up there, I said, why not? Why would I deny that? And you know what? If the county had come to me and said, hey, can we maybe use the section of that cemetery as a pauper cemetery? I'd probably say, yeah. If you want to be county, if we up there, clear some of the trees, we'd probably clear out a section to do that. But to bury people like this, this is disgusting. This is, what kind of human being does that? What kind of human being does that? He's still not calling. So obviously, I think what he had to hide was the fact that there were two bodies in that grave, and he did not want Miss Ellis to see that. And I think at this point today, he's still got something to hide. And so I agree with Mr. Murphy. Something's got to be done. There needs to be a formal investigation as to what happened here. And with that, I'll leave you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Miss.
Let me wrap this up. I've spent the last 2 months trying to grab all these pieces. It's a lot. I mean, there's so many moving parts, and I've done all these records requests, and I'm trying to keep it straight. And that's why I was very anxious when I came up here. I'm like, now I'd settled down and I was going to do this. The problem that we have now is Frederick Marshall was threatened by Verker, and Margaret Moriah got on the phone representing herself as the DA. I did an open records request on the DA, and he said they have no involvement in that. Frederick Marshall would gladly volunteer his phone records. I did an open records request on the DHS to see if anybody was paid. I don't know if I said this earlier. Michael and I notified him again Friday. He has not responded because there's money there to pay for this, for these indigent people if we need it. If any of that money went to the coroner, I'm not an attorney, but as a layman, I think that's corruption. And I'm waiting to get those documents. And I'm waiting from Verker to give me, you know, the follow through of when exactly were these bodies buried, which we're trying to find out too with the county. So the DA can't investigate. I talked to the sheriff about this. He can't investigate the coroner. We need outside sources to come in here. And I think that the Starkville Cemetery needs to be roped off. So we have pending on the Department of Human Services, depending on Mr. Verker. And I will tell you, because we're short on time, just like Penrose, I understand what's going on here. This is somebody's side hustle. I put the 7 through 9 in there, what happened with the ambulance, how much money was being made. It's a side hustle for somebody to make some money. And quite frankly, I've told people this story. But back in 2015, Dominic Verker sat down with me and he told me, as we're signing the death certificate, because we weren't completely on EDR, he says, you know, I've killed a man before. My brain starts spinning and I'm like, do I say congratulations or I'm sorry? I've lived here with the exception of a few years since the early 80s. I don't remember this. I knew we took care of a son in a tragic accident in the early 80s. I remember that, and that's almost 40 years ago. And then he tells me, I shot him several times and I got off because it was self-defense. I still don't know what to say. I'm like, wow. And then he says, and he was a big guy like you and I wasn't afraid. Do I take that as a threat? I did. But I didn't take it seriously because I didn't really think much of Mr. Verker. And I've had some other bizarre conversations with guys here that got to throw their machismo around. When I realized that was a threat a year later, I went to Anthony Mattei and Chief Glorioso and I said, do you remember this story? Because my wife didn't remember. She says, no. Anthony Mattei said, Tom, if it happened, I would know. And Charlie Glorioso says, yeah, I think I heard that story a couple of years. I'm like, huh, I don't know if it's true or not. But as I've shared that story with other men in this town, they're like, well, that was a threat. I'm like, okay. And what happened is when we had the Miller family, in 2016, the end of June, that got hit by the train. Pastor Alvin Yoder came to me the following year and said, Tom, I need to talk to you. I'm like, sure, Pastor, what? Come on up, have a cup of coffee. I don't know if you know him. He's a farmer out east, really nice guy. He said, Tom, I want to tell you what happened when the Millers died. He said, you know, it was on Sunday. I know we all knew because of Facebook and everything. And he says, when the parents of the family that died, sets of parents came in. He said, we went out to the farm and he said to him, he said, what funeral home do you want to choose? And they're like, we're not from here. We don't know. He said, well, let's pray on it. So when they drove to town, he pulled over and he said, what funeral home did you get? They said, we didn't get anything. He says, well, I got Murphy. So they called me up. So 5 out of 6 family members die on Sunday. We have their funeral on Friday. He said, Tom, when I told the coroner that I was going to choose you, he said, I think you should reconsider. And he tried to redirect Pastor Yoder and the family to go to another funeral. He said, Tom, that's not legal. He said, I have to fight for my water out in out east. And he says, so I have to know the rules and regulations of the water. They'll trick you or whatever. He said, that's just not right. It was then that I started the open records assault on him in 2016, where he admitted that he works for Comey Funeral Home making removals. Those are all in your documents. I tied it together as much as I could. There's still some holes. But number one, regardless of all that, if Dave Shire is there, if it was your family, you would turn over every rock and ask people to help you. And that's what this is about. I have my issues, but Darby, I'm just getting to know these guys, but Darby's been my friend for years and Paulins. I want to help them. And I'm sorry if I've offended you, Mr. Dornkamp. You helped me in 2000 when you first got elected in the snowstorm. When the sheriff at that time told me I had a death up in the mountains in a snowstorm, and he jumped in and started the vehicle up and we ran into you. I have a great deal of admiration for you. Just look at number 29, please explain, because I always have. That was above and beyond. So thank you. But please, I think the next thing that we're going to do is draft a letter to the Attorney General. I know someone that can get us in and say, here's the documents. Here's what we need to do. Right now, somebody needs to ask Sheriff Navarre to go tape that off and tell people that they can't go in there. Luis, thank you for the extra time. Anybody watching this, I hope you understand. I've known both of you gentlemen for decades. And calling you by your first name in a public meeting, for some people, thinks it's disrespectful. I'm not trying to do that. We just know each other. So please.
If I may, Tom, followed your instructions and appreciate and respect you for coming forward today and bringing this. As a Board of County Commissioners, we have to follow rules, regulations, statutes, and we will engage in this with our legal counsel moving forward to see what purview that this board has, if any, at that point in time. Mr. Mestis, thank you for bringing this information forward to us and spending your time with us today and bringing your information. And as well, the same situation holds there. This board has any purview, statutorily or not, we will look into it as well. Now, the Shire family, I know you all. Mr. Dad is a good man, and I hope we find some solace and some closure to this issue in the future. And again, this board has a particular position where we have to follow under state statutes and follow that to a T due to protect the other residents of the community as well. So with that being said, I apologize for having to go a little early. I did postpone that so we can get pushed on a little longer, and thank you for your time today. But again, thank you for bringing this forward, Tom. You know, appreciate your time.
Thank you, guys, and everyone watching.
Thank you. If there is no other business, I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second. Motion to adjourn.
I second that motion.
Commissioner Luiso?
Yes.
Excuse me. Commissioner Felix Lopez?
Yes.
Commissioner Luiso?
Yes.
I believe that the absolute department. Yes, sir.